This is the Living Clean Podcast. This podcast is not meant to replace meetings, sponsorship, step work, or service. This podcast is meant to be another tool in your recovery toolbox. Our guests are here to share their experience, strength, and hope with recovery through Narcotics Anonymous. Thank you for joining us. All right, welcome back to the Living Clean Podcast. I'm Mason S. I'm an addict. We are back for another episode. I'm going to introduce our guest, first starting with Francis.
My name is Francis. I'm an addict. My clean date is December 22nd, 1992. So the day of this recording, I'm celebrating 32 years clean. And I can't think of a better way to be celebrating my clean date with some Narcotics Anonymous history. So I'm super excited about being here and bearing witness to the history of Australia.
Absolutely. Francis, go ahead and introduce our guest.
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to let Derek introduce the other two guests. Derek is like my go-to history guy in Australia. And when I was involved with the Paradise Strong book study, he came and did a wonderful presentation for the history of Australia. They did a PowerPoint. And so I got to meet him at the World Convention. And one of the things that I was thinking about was that he had recently posted on social media about their region having they're reproducing the history book of Australia. So I'm like, let's get him and let's do another thing on Australian history, since they have a new book out with their region. Not a new book, but the old book has come back. So with that, I'm going to introduce Derek, and he'll introduce the other people that have come on.
Oh, hi, guys. Derek, addict, Sydney, Australia, blah, blah, blah. Clean date. Or as I first heard at meetings in the US, people say, you know, they introduce their clean date as God bless me on this day, blah, blah, blah. So God bless me on the 6th of June, 1979. That's my clean date. The 5th of June, the last day I used. And this isn't a story about my recovery. This will be a story about NA and my experience of NA in Sydney. So I know. So Janie H, who just stood up and ran away. I'm introducing you, darling, as a group member and hyperactive and my go-to girl when everything else fails around the eastern area of Sydney. James, I'm sure I know, but I don't know who else I'm introducing. Hey, James. Mary, Mia, she's a good buddy of mine. We're actually working in service together to get NA off the ground in Fiji. Mary's actually from Fiji, so that's a big win to have her in our quiver. We'll be starting meetings in the prison in Fiji in January. We've got all the stakeholders involved, blah, blah, blah. I don't know who the JFT is, and Christy F, I think, is Australian too, yes? Anyway, that's it for introductions.
All right, then, the stage is set. And without further ado, here's Derek.
Like I said, I'm Derek. I'm an addict. I got clean here in Sydney. I live here in Sydney, born and bred here in Sydney. Did my using here, mostly here and a little bit in Asia. Not going to go into my history too much, other than I was a heroin addict. I didn't come from a bad family, and I'm not a person that was, you know, that has trauma-induced addiction, if there is such a thing. I'm not even, you know, sure about the whole thing. You know, I'm pretty sure I was born with a condition. Anyway, long story short, I ended up in by absolute default, I ended up in a 12-step based rehab run by an old alcoholic who believed AA's 12 steps could work for heroin addicts. And, you know, that was 1977. I surrendered to the drug squad. Literally, I had 10 minutes and a taxi waiting for me to go. And I waited to get arrested because I knew it was over. Anyway, I ended up in this 12-step based rehab. And the guy who ran this rehab, David G, I would have to say, you know, of all the people I've met, he would, maybe it was because I was new and raw and didn't know anything and he knew everything. But he was like a Jedi Knight when it came to explaining the nature of the disease of addiction and the nature of 12-step recovery. And he single-handedly carried this message to me, which means he saved my life. And look, things got ugly. I learned some major things from him. I learned all about the 12 steps and the recovery process, and I learned what to do. I also learned what not to do. One of the big problems he had was he wasn't part of the we. He wasn't really part of it. My first recovery fellowship was actually his fellowship. It was called the Who's Fellowship. It was a rehab, but it was actually his fellowship, and there was a boss. And I got a firsthand, very searing, painful lesson in why we don't have bosses, you know, and none of us are good enough to make those kind of decisions. You know, group conscience is our only freaking hope, and even then, right? And like 3.5 years almost in that rehab, a suicide attempt. You know, I 6 months busted, 2 months busted, 10 and a half months busted. I know there was a whole story in that, but that's not the story we're here to tell today. And anyway, I left there in the end of 1980. I had 18 months clean time. And, you know, I'd done step four and five, and I really, you know, I knew the program worked. You know, I was back clean 18 months. And I left and joined a big fat AA group, and it was terrific. You know, lots of people, lots of members. I joined the group. The only thing I didn't do was get a sponsor. But anyway, 8 months out of rehab, 2.25 years clean. My flatmate had been whinging to one of these beautiful old timers in AA about not being able to tell his story from the floor, you know, to basically talk about shooting, smack, and kidnapping people and God knows what at, you know, AA meetings. AA was a lot more sort of middle class, and it wasn't, you know, peas on the back of the fork, mind you, but it was, you know, anyway. Having said that, you know, there were people in AA I knew who were like, yeah, the heaviest people I ever known, been involved in murdering people and God knows what. But anyway, but the general thing was, anyway. So this guy pulled him aside one day and said, listen, why don't you start an NA meeting? He'd been to America and, you know, I guess he'd seen NA and blah, blah, blah. And that guy's name was David S. And he came home. He was my flatmate. He was a, you know, I didn't really socialize in AA. They were all a lot older and, you know, but I socialized with Dave and, you know, we ended up moving in. He ended up moving into my apartment and, you know, he was great for me, really good for me. And, you know, we used to go night clubbing together and this and that. Anyway. So this guy's name was Bede. He's passed away now. Bede Donovan. People in AA would remember him with extreme reverence. He was just a beautiful cat. He was one of those cats you meet and think, "What? I don't even know what the fuck that is. What that guy's got, but I want it." You know, just being around him, I felt safe. You know, and yeah, you know, he really had this program. He and anyway, so on his suggestion, and Dave came home and he ran the idea by me. First words out of my mouth were, get fucked, not a prayer. You know, am I going to get involved with sleazy, slimy, smelly, fucking turn your grandmother inside out? Gutter rat junkies, of course, as I knew what they were because I was one. It seems awfully funny now. You know what it was? I just didn't want the responsibility. You know, I still had that thing. I was still fairly early recovery. The rehab experience, although it was extraordinary, and I got recovery, and that's really all that matters. It was intense, and there was stuff in there. And the boss of that rehab was 13-stepping girls in there. In fact, the last time I got kicked out of that rehab, the last time I got kicked out of that rehab. And, you know, one of my good friend's girlfriends came to me one day and said, I'm leaving the rehab. And I said, what's up? And she said, oh, you know, blah, blah, blah. He wants me to be one of his special girls. You know, he'd set up this little harem within there. And you know what? I judge him and I judged him and all of that, you know, left to my own devices, I would do the same thing. I've done it a little bit, you know, outside, just not with people in the rooms. Anyway, I capitulated with my mate and I said, look, I'd consider doing it if we can find one other person. So we had a group conscience of three people. I understood group conscience and how that worked and stuff. And I didn't want there to be a group conscience of just him and me arguing with each other like we did at home a lot of the time. Anyway, I rang my best mate Mario. I could have fallen out of my fucking chair when I said to Mario, look, do you want to be involved with this? And he said, fuck you, what a great idea. I got to tell you, that was not the response I expected to get from Mario. Anyway, the three of us made a commitment to each other to turn up every whatever day of the week it was going to be for 6 months and see how that meeting was going to go. So that was August 1981, and I can always remember it because I've got a good friend, Paul G., who had had 25 admissions to psych hospitals, 15 of them, you know, under handcuffed, and that was his first meeting. And he left that room and hasn't used since, you know, August 1981. And he's a good friend of mine. And he's actually a beautiful friend. He's one of, you know, one of the many blessings in recovery is, you know, the friends that, you know, if I let the program choose my friends, I'll be fine. You know, it's another one of those things. They're not the people I ended up hanging out with weren't necessarily the people I wanted to hang out with. The people I wanted to hang out with didn't stay clean. And, you know, I didn't hang out with those people because I knew that I needed to hang out with people that were doing what I was doing, which was staying super close to the program and being involved. Anyway, so we had this thing. So, you know, we got together and we got a venue. We actually started in the War Memorial Hospital in Waverley in the eastern suburbs of Sydney. And, you know, there were meetings of NA around at the time and I'd heard about them and it was a mess. And I, you know, I've interviewed Jim F., who, let me backtrack here a little bit. About 1986 or 87, I was the greeter at a big Sunday afternoon meeting we had in Darlinghurst. And, you know, I would stand at the door. It's like a side entrance to this hall. And I'm standing there doing the greeting and this guy's turned up in a suit, very unusual for an NA meeting, right? He's turned up in a suit and he was old. He was like 45, like 25 years younger than I am now, but to me, Ben. Anyway, he's turned up and, you know, I ushered him to sit down. He didn't want to sit down anyway. We shook hands and he just stood kind of there and the meeting was, you know, in front of me. And, you know, it was a big, good, great meeting. The guy in the chair was Kevin, what we used to call Kevin from Heaven. He was from New Zealand. He was like 5 or 6 or maybe 7 years clean. And, you know, it was a cracker barnstorming meeting. And when the meeting finished, I turned to this guy and he was standing there and he had tears running down his face. And I thought, you know, and he started to tell me the story. He was a doctor and he was a member of a version of NA that got to maybe 10 meetings a week in the 1960s in Sydney. Lots of doctors and nurses and stuff. And anyway, he said it got to maybe 10 or 12 meetings around the inner sort of, you know, Darlinghurst, Surrey Hills, North Sydney, etc. But he said it didn't last. They didn't use the, he didn't actually say they didn't use the traditions, but he said it fell apart. And, you know, I know why it fell apart. So all of that thing, the remnants of that or what was left, and including the guy who ran the rehab that I went into in 77, rebooted NA in 1972 in Sydney, and they called it Drugs Anonymous, which was actually a good move. So making it not drug specific, you know. Anyway, they got to 6 or maybe 7 or 8 meetings, and I do have actually a copy of the letter Garth, my good buddy and one of my peers, was around in the early days of the reboot of NA. I don't say the start of NA. I call what happened in 1981 a reboot. Anyway, so Garth's done a whole lot of research in the archives at NA World Services. Anyway, he found a letter, and there were like I said, maybe 5 or 6 or a few more, maybe a few. Anyway. Of those groups in 1975, those groups decided, you know, in contact with Jimmy Kay and everything, to join the Worldwide Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous and call themselves Narcotics Anonymous. And that's what they did. And David G was actually, he was what they called the GSR for all of those groups. And but when I got out of rehab, there were like 2 or 3 of those meetings still going. It worried me because they had government-funded literature. And the meetings were kind of run, one was run by a rehab here. And, you know, when it comes to the 12 traditions, it was a mess. It was fairly outside the 12 traditions. So I didn't bother going and I didn't really think much of it. And, you know, part of me really was a bit sort of resentful towards them. I just thought, but, you know, would I have done any different? I don't know. You know, anyway, we started that meeting in 1981. We were kind of scared of those other meetings, and having said we were scared and we didn't really know what to do, I assumed Mario and David felt the same way. And, you know, that they weren't really NA. We're just going to start it, run it by the traditions and see what happens. And the fucking thing exploded, like literally, you know. We were lucky. There were rehabs in Sydney that were pumping people with the 12 steps, like the one that I had gone through. I often encapsulate my experience in that rehab as I got exposed to a few more than 12 steps and a few less than 12 traditions. and that, you know, that's a punishing experience. But I got to tell you, I had no, all the shit I went through in there, you're going to love this. Anyway, I wasn't well and I wasn't happy, necessarily joyous and free. I mean, I was, but, you know, I was still in early recovery. Early recovery for me is quite long. Anyway, what did I want to say? When we started this meeting, we decided there was another meeting, a Friday night meeting, which was mostly AA members, but they were NA, and there was a girl called Mary who was secretary of that, and I think I can't remember the names of the people, but they were keen to go by the traditions and do things right, and because of that, they were kind of frowned upon by one or two of the other meetings. I don't understand the whole politics and I wasn't really there. But anyway, we decided to join that meeting and we all joined that meeting and took service positions. Mary was leaving anyway. She went back to South America and pretty much the people that were involved with the Waverley meeting that we started pretty much all got involved with this one too. Not very, very shortly after those two groups that were going, we formed, you know, and I know this because I was the driver behind it. An area service committee. We had the NA tree, which was that basic thing of group, area, region, world, blah, blah, blah. You know, we were nowhere near region, world. We had two groups, you know. But we formed an area service committee. We elected my sponsor, Pat. Pat S. was the first ever area rep we had. And I took on, it's funny, you know, I met with Mario and Dave to make that commitment to turn up. And neither Mario or Dave wanted to be secretary. I had the shits with them. I wanted to bang their heads together. I thought, you guys are for this idea. I'm fucking not, you know. Anyway, I stuck my hand up and I did the secretary thing for a year. And, you know, it was a pain in the ass. As everyone knows, when you're secretary of a meeting, you're also alternate tea person, alternate literature person, alternate cleaner, sweeper, alternate every fucking thing else when other people don't turn up. Anyway. Look, we all got very excited, you know, within... So I think within probably 3 or 4 months, we had an area service committee. And very quickly, that actually gave us like the train tracks for a train to run on, having that structure, that service structure. People bag it out and they, oh, it's not, you know, it's how we talk to each other, you know. And it was extremely important for communication. I believe our biggest challenge in recovery with service and everything is communication. I mean, have a look at the world, it would appear. Anyway, don't want to go down that. I couldn't rabbit hole, but anyway, so I think the third meeting that joined that area service committee was one of the old, there had been a meeting at McKinnon Unit, and there was a nurse there who was actually an NA member, and I wish I could remember his name. He was a ranger, you know, ginger hair guy. He was fucking lovely, you know. He was, so... anyway, and that was Richard or Peter or something. Anyway, you know, he restarted the meeting at McKinnon and joined the group. Anyway, by the end of the year, we had seven meetings a week, and it was fantastic. We had this little business card with, you know, are you in a, am I an addict, blah, 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 the NA phone line, and on the back, the seven meetings. You could fit the actual meetings list on the back of a business card. Anyway, we grew very rapidly. It was fantastic fun. You know, at the end of that, I committed for 6 months. I ended up doing 12 months as secretary. And I'll never forget, you know, when I resigned from that position, you know, I had a beautiful, beautiful feeling that, you know, deep down I have that bottomless low self-esteem that addicts have. It's just, I believe, generated by brain chemistry. Because I had that before. I was a maggot junkie robbing people and kidnapping and, you know, doing bank fraud and all that stuff. You know, I had that as far back as I can remember, you know, that I'm not, and I'm pretty much sure it seems to be that it's brain, anyway, whatever it is, I had it. And I had a day off, and my sponsor, who was the area delegate, wanted to retire. And so I had a day off, and then I became the area delegate. And anyway, at my home AA group, they had asked, they were looking for a secretary. You're going to love this story. It couldn't have, you know, on paper, I could probably take them to, you know, 12-step recovery court and, you know, whatever, and win a case. But, you know, God works in mysterious ways. They had asked me, I love that home group. I would do anything for it. It saved my life. It was like the life raft when I got out of rehab. And, yeah, anyway, they were having a group conscience the next week, and one of the people said to me, look, Derek, we're looking for a new secretary. The last thing I wanted, I was super busy with MA stuff. The last thing I wanted to do was, you know, another service commitment in AA, but I would never say no to them. So I said, look, I won't be here. I was going to a Toots and the Maytals concert the next week. And I said, I won't be here next week, but you've got a yes from me. If you want me to be secretary, I will. Anyway, I get back not that week, the week after they'd had the group conscience. And apparently they argued for an hour and a half, which made me feel quite important. But anyway, they ended up making a decision that I could not be secretary because I wasn't an alcoholic. So much for what Bill says in the big book, that you're an alcoholic if you say you are. Apparently not. Anyway, I'd be lying to say my feelings weren't hurt, especially because some of the people in that group conscience had voted, you know, were addicts, you know. In fact, all alcoholics are addicts, you know. They just, you know, it's like saying I'm a dog and I'm a German Shepherd, you know, a drug of choice. As we, you know, we were lucky. And Jimmy Kay was, you know, at a special time with a special headspace, you know, he was adamant and fought dramatically to keep that first step powers over our addiction, you know, and also keep the word we. I mean, it's assumed in the AA steps, but, you know, anyway. Yeah, so much as it hurt my feelings, it did help me let go of AA. And, you know, and I always had the opinion that NA, you know, was, you know, I had beautiful AA people around me that would say, Derek, you've got no idea how important. Deep down, I knew how important it was. That's why I had the shits, because I didn't want to do it, but I knew I fucking had to do it. I knew it was, you know, blind Freddie knew it was God's will. We were three junkies in AA who all had recovery. We had the gift. There's just no denying it. So, you know, I'm not, it's kind of like I had the Ferrari, the California Spider. Fuck if I'm going to let anyone else drive my California. Anyway, the problem is if I want to keep my California Spider, I got to let all you bastards drive it, which is just beautiful, really. You know, anyway, yeah, so I became area delegate and, you know, really it's all, everything we do in service is fellowship development. We didn't have the expression fellowship development back then, but that's what I was doing most of the time. We ended up with a fantastic service. We put together this thing. It must have been 83, 84. So it was a phone line service whereby you could ring NA. I don't know if anyone's old enough. I know a few. Janie and I will remember alphanumeric pages, state-of-the-art fucking CIA 007 shit back then. Anyway, well, I got 10 people in NA to stick their hand up. This is in the early 80s. So it was a bit of hoot. $30 a month each. That gave us $300, and we set up this phone line service, which meant that you could ring that phone line 24/7 and speak to a human being. It wasn't an addict, but that human being went through a little training course with us as to what they can and as to what they should and shouldn't do. So they had a visual display unit thing, very state of the art, where they could tell that addict at any time where the meetings were that day. You guys in America have developed that app where you can send your postcode and you get the three closest meetings to you within like 10 seconds. I love that thing. That is absolute gold. And I'm always on my, I'm the Eastern Area H&I chair here, and I'm the chair for the H&I men's prisons stuff. And I'm always, you know, telling people to use that thing. It's such a brilliant tool. Anyway, yeah, that was a nightmare to run. But what would happen also if the addict wanted to speak to another addict, they would send that addict's phone number to the pager. So we used to take shifts in carrying the pager. It was a beast to run and very expensive, but it gave addicts 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, access to another addict, and it was brilliant. You could actually call people back at public phone boxes. Anyone, the people here know what a public phone booth is? Anyway, so that was great. We did a lot of things, and we really, we put on conventions and stuff. I've still got a photo of myself at the first convention we ever had in Sydney, which was 1984. It's called Living Proof at Glebe Town Hall. I was as high as I think, an addict can be without using. And, it was a beautiful thing. And, we didn't always get everything right, but we were very, very hell-bent on the traditions. And, in the early days, Jimmy Kay resigned from the. I was in touch with Jimmy a bit about the fellowship and how it was growing and this and that. And, then they employed Bob Stone. And I remember ringing Bob one day and I said, listen, we're the biggest, fellowship outside of continental USA. I'd had dealings with, actually, he gave, I said to him, look, it's 3 months at best for you to post us literature. Just in the meantime, please give us, fax me 12 months permission, just permission to print NA pamphlets for 12 months. And that will get us over this year before we start getting a flow of literature from the state. It was a nightmare because it all had to come by boat and it was slow as a wet week. And we were definitely not going to do what the previous versions had done, which was get government-funded literature. We could have paid for it ourselves. But anyway, Bob Stone did that. And so from about, I think, maybe mid-82 to mid-83, we had permission to print. We printed some pamphlets here and then the stuff started to arrive from the US and blah, blah, blah. And I started to grow outside of Sydney a bit. And I think in 1984, maybe 1983 or 1984, Mario and I went down to Melbourne to try and help them with their area committee and, try and help them because we were growing way, way faster in Sydney than they were down there. And that was a bit of a worry. And we just thought maybe, we could help them. We went down there. I don't know if we were any help or not. We created more problems. That wasn't our intention. You buck and other buckers need to do it this way. That always works well, right? What's wrong with you, cunts, is this? That wasn't really what we did, but it was really so in 19, so I did that area thing for area delegate for 3.5 years, and it was great fun, and and then we became a we Mario was the alternate area delegate, and we went in one fell swoop. We went from Mario went from being alternate area delegate to regional delegate, regional what they used to call then regional service representative. So in 1985. So I went for 82, 1985, it must have been late 85 or maybe 86, we became a region, and we became a region with New Zealand incorporated. So it was called the Australasian region. And look, which has been growing, at pace ever since. As far as the rest of the history goes, like I said, we became a region, and I'd say, well, I think it was late 85. It's in the book anyway. Probably irrelevant whether it was late 85 or 86, but it really I kind of when we started sending delegates to the World Service Conference, and Mario was our first ever delegate that went to the World Service Conference, and they were very, God bless them, they were very keen to de-Americanize or the fellowship. As pretty much all the delegates, all the board members, and that were, Americans. And anyway, as soon as Mario's commitment as regional delegate was over, they snaffled him onto the board, and then Garth, I think was Mario's alternate. As soon as his thing, he got snaffled onto the board as well. And as far as the history, so I think basic statistics. We started in August 1981. Within a year, we had 7 meetings a week. Within 3 years, or it might have been 2 years, we had 21 meetings a week. When the fellowship really started to pound was when we had lunchtime meetings. So people could go to 2 meetings a day and they were much more likely to be able to stay clean. And then we grew to, 91 meetings a week in 10 years. That was all amazing. We had some amazing things. Corinne, one of my friends, started this 48-hour meeting over the weekend in the late 80s in Sydney. and we just used to take 2 hour shifts. I remember doing the dog shift to 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. on a Sunday morning. That was interesting. A lot of people after nightclubs and this, that, and the other, and that was great. You never knew what to, every now and again some famous Hollywood actor would walk in. And here's a funny thing, just a little snippet of history. In 1989, in the summer edition of Rolling Stone magazine, they used to have this thing. It was kind of tongue in cheek, the 10 hippest things to do this summer. So number two on the summer edition of Rolling Stone was join NA, which I thought was very cute, blah, blah, blah. We had a lot of stars and film people and, and world famous, one in particular, world famous artist and this and that. But I do remember thinking, we used to be known as the Mega Hip Fellowship, and that's great and everything. But, it's so much more important than that. It's so much more three-dimensional than that. And I remember thinking that's very, very cool, but it could also, have a negative effect. Anyway, blah, 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 whatever it is. We've survived all of those things. I ended up being roped, got roped into, being the delegate for Australia in 89 and 90. I said, I was asked, I came to the region. I said, look, I'll do it if you don't have it. They didn't have anyone else that wanted to do it that had service experience and stuff. So I said, I'd do it. And that was good. And, ended up, I would have been at the end of my commitment. It was a 2 year commitment back in those days. At the end of my commitment, they, I was asked to run for the board, and which I did. In the end, it came down to a vote between me and two other people. So they had another round of voting, and then it was a vote between me and another guy who was a trial barrister, and I thought a very clever guy. And I honestly thought he would be better for the position. He'd actually been world policy chair, and I remember being super, super impressed with his report to the World Service Conference. It was fucking funny. I mean, it was funny. It was adroit and clever. And I thought this guy would be better on the board than me. And I voted for him, and he won by one vote. And I always remember thinking, if I'd have voted for myself in bad conscience, because I have the utmost respect for NA, and I really, I've been a bit of a whore outside the rooms, but not in the rooms. I don't know. I try to act as good in the room, as good outside the rooms, and it is. It's a lifestyle, the principles and all that, but I would never have been able to live with myself if I'd have, if I'd have voted that, and most of, anyway, so that's a snippet of, well, probably not much to do with the history, really, my history. It's all about me, right? Anyway. So how are we today? I got to tell you, I'm watching COVID and, how, I remember that World Services sent out a survey. And it was, we were approached, World Services were approached by some business analysts in the States because they were so impressed with how well, how quickly, and how adaptive we were to the online platform. In reality, this is a life and death situation. So we have more than money at stake, businesses just, but it was very interesting to see how we'd done that. I'm not sure what more I can really talk about the history as far as the details. So with this little book here, about 10 or 12 years ago, I'm still in contact with the girl that actually wrote it. She didn't go to meetings anymore, but she did an absolutely brilliant job with this, even though she did interview me, and I would slightly beg to differ on some of the stuff she wrote in here. That, wasn't how I remember it. Fuck, who cares? It's pretty much the story. And I was asked by Tony, our Fellowship Service Office Director, to go back. This was maybe 10 years ago, just to check all the details in the book. I've gone around and visited pretty much all the areas, or at least by phone, just to check up on what there's written in here, if that's really how they remember it. And the guys from Melbourne, pretty much it was, we rewrote the bit from Melbourne, but it's really just a rewording of what was already in there and just tidying up. It appears that, all the facts are pretty much right. It's all in there anyway, but when we became a region and all of that stuff, it's I used to be angry with the early people of NA and everything. And I thought, Yeah, you know, that's kind of a prick attitude to have. I had an extremely good teacher, and that guy who ran that rehab, I always think, you know, I say that it was like a kind of postgraduate degree in what to do and what not to do. And, you know, like I say, that guy who ran that rehab, he wasn't part of the we, so he didn't have people. I had peers that if I'm, you know, wandering off the path or my attitude stinks or whatever, they'll tell me. He didn't have that. I tried to tell him, and I got that last time I got kicked out of the rehab was because I called him out on his 13 stepping girls in there. Actually, I was trying to protect this girl from him. Anyway, I got kicked out of the rehab. What actually happened was I was kicked out in the country. It was anyway, and I hitchhiked back to Sydney. And you know, that next day, the girls in the rehab rang me and said, "Look, that was shit. That was bullshit. They were going to mutiny in there." So they rang me and said, "You could come back." As soon as I knew I could come back, I went and used. And that was June the 5th. And I still had that junkie, dishonest head on. And anyway, that was a lot. I managed to get back in the rehab, just like really, just. It was really because a guy who was admitting me, who later I became his sponsor, I was coming down. I'd been using it. I used to use Ritalin intravenously, and I was coming down. I had this sort of panic going on as I was being admitted into the office. And he must have felt it. And he just put his hand out, put it on my arm, and he said, "Mate, you'll be okay." And I believe that stopped me from running. And I've been clean ever since. And he's a good friend of mine today. I don't see him much. He lives south of Sydney, and, you know. But yeah, so I'm involved in service in different ways. Most of my service here in Sydney is H&I in the prisons. And, you know, just before COVID that year, we had 19 face-to-face meetings in the prisons in Sydney, which is a nightmare to run, but you know, what a fabulous, fabulous thing. I had guys from the Northern Beaches, which is the other side of Sydney. They would go out to Parklea Prison, which is on the other side of Sydney, on the weekend, you know, and do 3 1-hour meetings back to back. That's a big commitment. We had guys going in Saturday, they do. Sorry? Oh. I thought I heard someone say it was that. Anyway, you know, these guys know who they are, and they're still involved with that prison today. We don't have as many. COVID shut a lot of things down, and reconstructing it's been a bit of an issue, been a bit of work and stuff. But you know, we're up and running again. And yeah, I'm going to just be babbling and looking for things to talk about now. I know that.
Let me jump in for a minute. Ask a question. So you talk about being involved in H and I. So since the start of your, the NA that kind of adopted the traditions in the early 80s, what is when did H and I start to become a thing, and when did you get involved with that?
So H&I became a thing pretty much straight away. When we started that meeting, Mario and I and Dave S and I, like the three, and Robert D and Garth P and that, we used to go around to the detoxes and we used to comb the detoxes, like literally. You know, anyone want to come to a meeting? You know, blah, blah, blah. So that was as early as 1980, at the end of 1981, like I'd say, you know. And we were super keen. Oh, I got to tell you, that first NA meeting, here's a little snippet of my history, and it's a bit of NA history. I left that rehab one time. I bounced out of that rehab, and I just thought, I'm never going to get clean. In the AA book, there's a line in that book that says, "There are those poor unfortunate, those who cannot or will not be completely honest with themselves." I was a lying fucking swine. I was incapable of being honest with myself, of myself, but with your help. Anyway, I thought that was me. I decided to knock myself. I wasn't afraid of dying. I was just afraid of living. I just couldn't go on the way I was. You know, hopefully I'll be doing an H&I this Wednesday at Gorman House. If I'm not down at my brother's house making amends, I'll be doing an H&I at one of the local detoxes here with the younger brother of the best friend, one of my best friends, using junkie. And so the last time I saw this guy's brother, I overdosed him and robbed him for half an ounce. You know, so I was really a piece of work. But fuck, I lost my train of thought there. Oh yeah, what I was going to say. So H&I, so we were doing that. That's not really a H&I meeting, but we would go in there. I guess it's much the same as an H&I. Formally, we started H&I in the prisons in 1983, and we started in Long Bay in 1984. But in 1983, we started in Silverwater. You're going to love this story. My first sponsee, a guy called Max Kewish, his job in prison was bottling Palfium. If there are any old junkies here, know what that is. It's a fucking strong narcotic, you know. So his job was putting tablets in bottles, you know, 50 for you, 25 for me, 50 for you. So he had it all through his job, you know. He had access to Palfiums, and quite a strong narcotic for those that weren't narcotics users. Anyway, pretty funny. So we started there in 1980, 83, and Long Base in 1984. And that's waxed and waned, depending on, you know, obviously 20 years ago, they did, you know, I spoke to the 2IC of Corrective Services in New South Wales. And he said, he explained to me that he used to be in charge of all the AA and NA coming into all the different jails. And he said that they made a conscious decision. So it was probably 20, 25 years ago to push back against the 12-step thing and go with harm minimization. And now, you know, I don't know if they run CBT groups and, you know, smart recovery and all that in the jails and that, but we're always there. It's, you know, lately, and, you know, it goes through different periods where they're real friendly and a completely, lately, all the services and programs, offices and stuff seem to be really on the money. I've got jails contacting me because I've been doing it for so long, 41 years now. You know, a lot of them know me and this and that. But I've got jails wanting to start. I just don't have enough people to man them. So mostly I go to meetings pretty much all the time. Janie will know this, and I make the announcement about anyone wants to do, you know, you need 12 months clean time, 5 years, no regular conviction. I often tongue in cheek say, just queue up over there at the end of the meeting and I'll get to you eventually. You know, I'll have someone at one in 10 meetings. Lucky I go to a lot of meetings. But yeah, so at the moment we have one, four, five, six, seven meetings a week at Long Bay Prison. We have two meetings a week at, so of all up of the prisons, we've probably got, including the online ones, maybe 20 meetings a week. But a lot of those are not in Sydney. So I'm in the, I'm having grown up with a service structure, I'm in a very unenviable, sort of uncomfortable position here because I'm running meetings in. So we're looking at actually reforming a regional H&I committee. That way I have somewhere, because there isn't actually, you know, the meetings I'm running in country New South Wales, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'd like to see a quasi thing. We'll probably jump on the end of the public relations committee and maybe even including outreach, because I imagine we'll run Fiji from here. You know, until it gets up and running by itself, you know. But I always find it's extremely important to have a single point of accountability. It talks about that in our concepts and our service and stuff. You know, Derek doesn't want to be a running off running Derek's H&I show. That's not going to help for anyone, Derek included, or Derek especially, probably. So, yeah, so we probably have seven, eight, nine, 10, 11. Yeah, maybe 20 odd H&I meetings a week. It could be much more. Some of those are online. Some of those you don't need, you know. For clearance here, you've got to go through a process of filling out six forms. They get submitted. They do a criminal record inquiry check on you. Then you get an email to go and set up a little, what they call a Thrive account, and you've got to go and do an online. You've got to go and do an online security awareness course, and you got to do it every year. It's a bit of a pain. Takes about an hour and a half, and you know, yeah.
Do you feel like COVID was the biggest challenge to overcome as far as what you guys dealt with in Australia? Or is there another event that kind of sticks out that you think was more significant?
Well, I think in a big like generalization, I think we got we were very spoiled in Sydney with lots and lots of rehabs, and we still are. And in fact, you know, one of my besties runs a big, you know, it's got a methadone to abstinence, it's got a replacement therapy to abstinence service. It's got a replacement therapy stabilizer where people can come in, they don't have to come off their replacement therapy and just get stable. They've got a women's program, a men's program. We've got some great ones for people coming straight out of jail. In fact, a guy who was in jail when I was doing H&I there 20-something years ago. He was at my home group last week, Jerry, you got 17 years up. He's now taken over the management of one of these things, which is predominantly for First Nation and people coming straight out of jail. And he is the guy to be in the box position, you know. He was a, you know, hope to die junkie, come out of jail, you know, been clean 17 years now. And, you know, so we got lots of rehabs and stuff. And I guess what was your question again?
Well, I was asking, like, what was some of the biggest challenges you faced? Was it COVID or was it,
you know? No, I think one of the challenges was we got very, and it may well still be today, we got very kind of dependent on rehab to do our 12-step work for us. You don't see the people going out and combing the, you know, the detoxes and this and that. You do see a lot of H&I in the detox. Having said that, you know, the detox I'm doing on Wednesday night, if I'm not making amends to my brother, is, you know, is fucking fantastic. Excuse the F word. But they have two NA meetings a week, one CMA, which is Crystal Meth Anonymous. I don't know if you guys have that in the States or wherever you're from.
We do. One A.
So they have four meetings a week in the detox, you know, and it's one of the bigger detoxes. And a lot of the detoxes are like that. And, you know, the rehabs go out to meetings mostly too. And, I think one of the big challenges, I actually think, although it's, you know, even for just technology, you know, I think COVID actually was a bonus. One of the things we did here, and we've got a very, you know, got good Liberal government stuff. We were a mental health support team. So during COVID, we were the last ones have to shut down fully. And we were always, no matter how hard the lockdown got, well, in Sydney anyway, I'm not sure about Melbourne, but I'm pretty sure it was much the same. And though Melbourne had the hardest lockdowns of anywhere in the world. But we were always allowed to, what we started were pop-up meetings in the park. You know, you weren't allowed to drive. You weren't allowed to have six people in your car because you still had to maintain. But, you know, we were allowed to have these meetings. And I remember being in Glebe, in Blackwattle Park in Glebe. It was a beautiful sunny day. They looked like shark pods. We had 15 people in each one, and we had three of those with the meetings going. And we had this guy from the council come down and he started taking photos. And I said, look, this is a self-help group. It's also anonymous. If you wouldn't mind, he said, I just have to report back to council what you're doing. So I explained to him what we were doing. He said, listen, I've got an app on my phone which can, you know, mute out the faces. Are you okay with that? And I said, you know, I went to the groups. Everyone was fine with that. So we did that. But, you know, actually, I think, and what we have now, Janie actually is a massive promulgator of this and involved in service on these. We have a couple of meetings that are incredibly good at carrying the mess, incredibly good for the newcomer because they're every single day. My home group is a 7 a.m. We call it the ICU, the intensive care unit, and it's 6 days a week, 7 a.m. The magnificent thing about this meeting and the ones that Janie runs, they're every day, the same people. So people can come to my home group, newcomers, and within a week or two actually feel part of it. And I remember when I got out of rehab at the end of 1980 and I joined that AA group, one of my besties is a guy called Brewery Bill. Janie knows it, you know. He's an 80-year-old alcoholic. He's like 52 years up now or something. He pulled me aside one day and he said, listen, Derek, you're going to feel around this and not in it. Just keep coming. You'll eventually feel a part of it. So, and another thing that I've noticed, and I've gotten this from quite a few newcomers, it's much, much less threatening to go to an online meeting where you don't have to use your own name. You don't even have to turn your camera on when you first come around. And so I'm not sure there's even been a negative with, you know, I'm not boots on the ground too much with the online meetings. I was, in fact, I chaired the first one for about 8 or 9 months because I was desperately scared for people that, you know, couldn't get to meetings. And one of our home group members, you know, the day after we went into full lockdown, sent me this and he said, this is it. You're in the chair until further notice. Yes, sir. You know, and, you know, it was beautiful. The online meetings just happened overnight almost. And so realistically, I'm not sure it hasn't actually been a bonus. I know it's been a bonus for the whole population in a sense, you know, people can work from home 2 or 3 days a week, blah, blah, blah. I still think there's probably probably, I don't know, there's probably no substitute for face-to-face, but you know, I'm not sure of that either. Time will tell. Most of these things, you know, time will tell, and they will, you know, like water will find its own path. You know, case in point, sharing at meetings whilst on replacement therapy. You know, the Board of Trustees put a paper out 35, 6, 7 years ago, and our thinking at the time was, you know, it's best if people don't share if they're on replacement therapy, and people would be asked not to share if they are on replacement therapy. And I know the rehab where that I mentioned, you know, they would tell their clients that are on replacement therapy not to share. You know, they were, it was part of the rehab rules. Anyway, over the years, that just sort of, you know, I think with people's genuine desire to have people fully participate, and I guess if you really read Tradition 3, it says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. It doesn't say you have to be clean. We suggest that you come back clean after your first meeting, but that doesn't always happen. And I've got to tell you, I'll share a funny experience, right? I'm in Byron Bay. I'm at one of the lunchtime meetings, and this girl shared she was on replacement therapy. I thought I'll do the right thing. After the meeting, I went up and spoke to her about, look, you know, we think it's probably best if people don't. She bit my fucking head off, you know. It was fucking funny, you know. 10 years later, I've changed my mind from what I've seen of people. We seem to have gained more from people being able to share whilst on replacement therapy. Most of them have come off at a faster rate than maybe they would have if they didn't, you know, if they weren't allowed to share. Anyway, that's what it looked. Anyway, I'm in Melbourne, you know, as I often go to Melbourne. I love the fellowship down there at a meeting, big Friday night meeting, and there's a girl celebrating 10 years. Anyway, she came up to me after the meeting and said, you know, you remember me? I'm the girl you spoke to at Byron Bay, and I bit your fucking head off because you told me I shouldn't share while I'm on replacement therapy. I'm 10 years clean now. And I said to her, you want to hear something funny? I said, I think I was wrong then, you know. I think, you know, she was of the ilk that you shouldn't. But, you know, it just, I'm just making an observation of someone who's on the ground and watched a lot of things. I could be wrong. In 10 years' time, we'll look back and think, no, we were wrong about that. We shot ourselves in the foot. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I think you bring up some interesting points, too, going back to the H&I. You talked about a dependence on treatment centers, you know, for getting our newcomers. And, you know, I've never thought about it in that context, but that's such a great point, because what it does is we get so dependent on it that our other public relations entities kind of suffer, and we miss out on these other routes that people can find our fellowship too. I think that's interesting.
I sometimes think that, you know, like our society changes faster than our service structure. And like, and so how do we approach treatment centers? You know, like maybe it'd be better to like create carpooling to the local speaker meeting than it would be trying to exhaust all our people at the local meetings and speaking at the local treatment center. You know, like how many different times do I have to go and speak at the Salvation Army? You know, like, or is, would it be better just to try to figure out how to get them to the local meeting, you know?
So a lot of the ones, especially the private ones, that we used to do all of that. In fact, my first home group, when we started that meeting in August 1981 in Waverley, we had a meeting in one section of the War Memorial Hospital, then we moved to another section, and then we ended up moving up the road to a kindergarten, and there were two rooms. We had one room where we would have the meeting, and we would provide child minding. Group members would mind the children. Well, these are things you can't do today, you know. Anyway, and you know what's really weird? I'll share this here. It's on record. That guy that ran the rehab that carried the message to me, that taught me everything I know and saved my life, he went to prison for molesting his own children. It was, you know, there was 13 stepping going on in the rehab. I had no idea. He'd been molested as a child. But anyway, he ended up going to prison for that. And that was kind of like, you know, heavy thing. The guy who saved my life became the only human being I knew that I would avoid the road, or I would cross the road to avoid bumping into. So it was a painful, but must know lesson that it's the message, not the messenger. None of us are above ever using again, you know, and none of us, you know, it's a daily reprieve, like Bill and Bob said. And, you know, I felt terribly sorry for that guy, but there were times, even in the rehab, I went out, I ended up getting between. It's a whole other Jonestown story I could tell you about. I was in that rehab for nearly 3.5 years, and I watched it grow from a 5-bedroom house with him and 45 junkies. And, you know, when I say that, I look back now and I think, what a job that guy did. What a fucking job he did. Literally a house full of 45 lying, cheating, conniving, junkie rats, you know. And, you know, he did what he, what, two, you know, by the end of 1978 or 1979, you know, we had a big agricultural college. It was a 200 people, a massive therapeutic community, you know, like 200 inmates, 200 clients type of thing. And, you know, but he wasn't part of it. And I learned that, you know, fellowships are great. Our fellowship, I learned all of the problems that happened in that rehab. There was a corresponding tradition that would have, you know, saved us from that, saved him from that. You know, no one could call him out. I tried to call him out on his stuff. He slept with a girl the night before she got married to a guy in that rehab. And for me, that was the last straw. I thought, I'm going to hurt this guy. I'm going to hurt him to get his attention. You know, what he's doing is just not okay. There were rumors about young, you know, there was a 14-year-old girl apparently left pregnant to him. There's every chance that that actually did happen, unbeknownst to me. Most of the rumors were actually true. You know, I knew he was out. Anyway, he ended up getting booted out of the rehab and this and that. But a few years later, he actually went to prison for molesting his own children. And what a, you know, long before that, here's the thing. So when we had that meeting at Waverley, when we were celebrating our first birthday, he was still around and none of this stuff with children had come out or anything. Anyway, I said to him, why don't, you know, he came along to our first birthday and we had, they used to call me the NAPD, like the NA Police Department. I was like the traditions copper. And I was like that because I was scared and I had seen NA, you know, misrepresented. To be honest, I say I was angry with those people that I was also, like, I understand now they were doing the best with what they had, but they misrepresented NA. So what, in my humble opinion, or what it looked like to me was NA had no reputation. It actually had a bad reputation because it was dysfunctional because it didn't have the tradition. So anyway, so we had a big group conscience, probably 15, 16, 18 people. And I was secretary still. It was just towards the end, and I was about to resign as secretary. And we had this big group conscience. And I said to David, I said to this guy, I said, David, you should get involved. You know, you've got 15 years up. You'd be a great help. He looked at me, and it was the first time I really, really saw how ego-driven he was. And he said to me, and how little he actually understood of all of the things he actually taught us, like crazy. But, you know, we can wander off the path and nothing will wander us off the path quicker than ego. Anyway, what he said to me, like, it's still, I find it chilling. I said to David, you know, you should get involved. He looked at me and he said, oh, Derek, if I got involved, I'd want to run it. And I said to him, David, and I was really clear, quite loud and not authoritative, but definitely not ambiguous in any way. I said, David, if you hear nothing else, please hear this. That will never, ever happen. I'm not having any one person running NA. But he needed to hear that that was not going to happen. Anyway, he didn't come back. And I never realized how out of control his ego was, you know. And the beauty.
I wanted to speak to that affiliation stuff was recently Chris shared a Chris B of Chris and Boyd shared an article with us about a gentleman named Harry Shire and who happened to be a pedophile, and he ran a sanitarium in North Hollywood. And so this was the second location of Narcotics Anonymous. So we moved from the the location where NA started in 1953 at Kintera and Clybourne, where we've all seen that flyer, over to Shire's Dryer, which was like an alcoholic dryout center. And, Chris sends us this article about this guy, and the article was written by one of the victims that he had molested. And, I'm like, oh my God, so we move over to this place, they're offering us free rent. So we're in violation of the seventh tradition. And then, we have free rent, and all of a sudden we're being affiliated with this place. And then there's an investigation of the guy that's running the place. Is like, what does that do to Narcotics Anonymous? When we're taking favors or whatever's going on. No wonder it folded by 1959 when we were meeting at that place. That's when Cy Malis handed the stuff over to Jimmy, and Jimmy says, now we're going to use the traditions. And that's when NA flourished, is when we actually use the traditions. But I think that kind of thing happens over and over again when we're not using the traditions. So I wanted to ask you about the basic text. And what year did you get clean?
79. Yes, I was involved with the basic text, not barely much. I actually spent some time with Jimmy in 82. He what a lovely cat he was. We'd been in contact anyway, because I used to talk to him about NA and this and that. One of the greatest regrets for me is Jimmy sent me a postcard from his deathbed, just saying, wow, it sounds like NA, I think it was, 85 or 86. And, saying, wow, we'd really grown massively, and it was on fire. And, anyway, I lost that fucking thing, and I'm on the fucking archiving committee. What a beautiful piece of history personally for me. And, Jimmy was just an ordinary human being, but he was just like as high as a car. It's like a 2-year-old. He reminded me when I met him, spent time with him, he reminded me of me as a 6-year-old kid on Christmas Day. My dad used to spoil the shit out of us. He was very naughty. My dad died in a plane crash when I was 7, but he was an amazing man. We lived in a big mansion with live-in maids, and it was fucking Camelot, But running down to the Christmas tree on Christmas Day was just like, that's what Jimmy was like with NA. And so in 1982, I spent some time with him proofreading. He spent the whole day with me. I was in LA on my way to, I was with my mother, who had got sober in AA 2 years before I got clean. We were going to an AA roundup in Honolulu. But I've been in touch with Jimmy a fair bit just about, this and that and office stuff. Anyway, I got to spend the day with him. He devoted his whole day to me, took me to the office, and we ran around there. And I remember thinking to myself at the time, you're too old to be running this thing,
Which did you read the fourth and the ninth traditions with him by chance?
Oh, if I did, I can't remember them. He actually gave me two copies of the for review.
Oh, and actually, wow.
Watching Chris and Bull, I got really excited because I brought one of them home with me, and I'd given it to this guy told me I gave it to him. I remember lending it to him. Anyway, he's still got it. It's fucking rubbish. But I was thinking, Chris and Boy were saying they were all numbered, and Jimmy had numbers 1 and 2. And I thought to myself, fuck me, Jimmy gave me one, but I think it must have been a reprint because it wasn't numbered. I thought to myself for a minute there, I got major wood over the fact that maybe Jimmy gave me one of his number 1 and 2. Anyway, that didn't happen.
I'm not sure that the review drafts were numbered. I know that the basic texts were.
They were.
Oh, they were? Hey, so how did that change Narcotics Anonymous in Sydney? I know there was a lot of people that struggled. We started developing our own language after the basic text, and you were kind of saying that Australia didn't take off until the early 80s, and I'm wondering maybe the effect, it wasn't the same as it was here in the States, because we were kind of entrenched with Alcoholics Anonymous quite a bit because we have a longer history, and people really had their feelings hurt about you know, like us developing our own language. Is that something that happened there?
Look, we were a little bit tainted with that kind of, you know, people getting the shits if you happen. And in fact, so I think what you're referring to really is the clarity statement.
Sure.
Yeah. So, and people don't really know this. And like, it might be appropriate in some areas. I'll be honest with you. I just have gotten progressively more and more uncomfortable with that. That it's not NA approved literature. People don't know that. It's an excerpt written by a trustee. It's a brilliant write. It's brilliantly written and everything, but it's an excerpt written some 35, maybe 38 years ago. And it's just an excerpt from a paper. AA loved it. You know, they were kind of terrible. I don't know. You know, the idea is, so, like I say, I've gotten progressively more and more uncomfortable, especially like a lot of rehabs take their clients to AA and NA, you know, and no one listens to it anyway. I sit in meetings where they still read it sometimes, and I often open my mouth and I say, look, that thing you read is not actually NA approved literature. I'd be more comfortable if we just, you know, read the stuff that's approved anyway. I know for a fact twice that has been to the world in the last 15 years, that clarity statement has been to the World Service Conference to be voted on and brought in as you know, conference approved literature, and twice it didn't get up. So anyway, I just think sometimes I think it actually declarifies the situation. I don't know anyone that thinks there's two diseases. You know what I mean? Whether you call it alcoholism or drug addiction or, you know, addiction. But anyway, so we didn't really have, you know, people were keen to, and I know it's a thing, it's a normal thing. It's like a teenager leaving home trying to assert their own authority or, you know, and have their own boundaries and stuff, which I think is great because, you know, I've seen fellowships where the older members did not do that, did not let go of AA and everything. And, you know, NA became their sort of little toy. They were the older members and everything. But, you know, anyway, in answer to your question, I'm not really sure. Do you want to ask me the question again, please?
I was just wondering if people had their feelings hurt when we were asking them to speak the NA language. And like, A lot of people here in Northern California or in Southern California, where NA has been around a lot longer, they were kind of really entrenched with using the other fellowships literature. And like, maybe that wasn't something that happened there because, you know, like NA developed as we got a basic text, basically.
Yeah, no, we had a little bit of it here too. I remember, you know, I think the first meeting that started on the north side was at one of the big hospitals, and they used to use the AA big book and stuff. And, you know, eventually we just faded out of that. We didn't have a book, did we? You know, we had the little white book. In fact, I shared at the 2018 convention, and someone came along and the convention committee gave me a little copy of the 1963 version of the little white book. It's like a tiny, you know, but I think once we got our own book, I think people have got there was, and I know there was a lot of it in the US, that kind of jackbooting across the top of people about not using NA language and stuff, you know. I think people were run out of meetings for using the word sober. I've heard stories like that. Haven't heard much of it here, and it's pretty, you know, we don't, you know, maybe 20, 30 years ago was a thing, maybe 40 years ago was a bit of a thing, but I don't hear it now. I rarely actually ever hear the clarity statement read, but and when I do, usually the next person gets up and says, "My name's Mary, you know, Mary, and I'm an alcoholic," and you know, or they say, you know, so I don't think that much of a problem. That's the mother. Yeah, that's it.
Did you guys see my laptop fall off the desk?
We did.
I'm glad. I was muted.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I have one of those. It's sweet. Actually, the language is slightly different in that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's drastically different.
Somebody has their hand up. Are we going to take that question?
Sure.
So my question is, and thank you for sharing, this is fascinating. Do you know if Jimmy had a sponsor?
Yeah, he had an AA sponsor. I don't know who it was. I did see some dialogue, and I think it's in that Chris and Boyd's History of NA. I know that his AA big book had a notation from Lois Wilson in it, wishing Jimmy all the best for his recovery, which is kind of sweet. I got to tell you, yeah, I feel like we're crying sometimes, that stuff. You know, how lucky we are to have been touched by this thing. You know, had I not ended up in that rehab with that guy who carried the message. Crook as he was, when I got there, he had a 19-year-old wife. He'd already had one kid to her, or maybe she was 20 or 21 and he'd had two kids to her. She'd gone into that rehab as a 19-year-old, you know, pot smoking bank teller. She ended up in there, but you know, anyway, and he, but still he saved my life. And it's the message. And you know, about 5 or 6 years ago, this appeared on eBay, and it was Jimmy Kay's, the first two editions of the first ever basic text of NA, and had notations from Jimmy in both of them. And they were on eBay for 100,000 US. Anyway, which I'd been my bro, I owned part of a business that just sold, and I was desperate. I spoke to Anthony at the World, so he said, no, it's way overpriced. Forget it. We'll get it. We'll end up with it eventually. Don't be paying that sort of silly money for it, you know. But I just thought, I don't want it to slip into anyone's hands. I don't need it for me personally. But you know, I just thought, wow, you know, I want those things to be in the NA World Service office or somewhere for our archiving, you know. And I just feel tremendously blessed that I got to spend that time with Jimmy. And you know, he was just beautiful, you know, just yeah.
Believe his sponsor's name was Eddie Cochran from Alcoholics Anonymous, Jimmy's. And then, yeah,
All right,
forgot
looks
what
like
it is.
we got a couple of more hands raised. Chip, did you have a question?
Okay, so now my question, you I always have questions all the time. The people that know me, so bear with me because I can get on a roll. Is in Australia, when we use actually establish at as a fellowship, what year was that?
Well, it varied in different cities. NA started in Melbourne in 1976,
Okay.
and they've been content that meeting has been continuously going since then. In Sydney, we had several stop starts. In the 1960s, we got to about 80, 8 to 10 meetings a week, and then it fell apart. It rebooted in 1972. It called itself Drugs Anonymous, and they had a press release. I have a copy of that on my phone. Just saying why they changed the why they used the word Drugs Anonymous, so it wasn't specifically for, you know, narcotics or speed or whatever. And then in 1975, those meetings, of which there were five or six, made a group conscious decision, all of them, you know, to join the Worldwide Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, and wrote to Jimmy, and Jimmy had them put on the world meetings list and stuff. And yeah. So when I got out of rehab at the end of 1980, what was left of those five or six meetings was, in my experience, not really what we would call NA. They weren't really running by the traditions, and they had government-funded literature. They also had a book, and my friend Garth's got a copy of it. Garth is really our go-to history archiving guy. He's got that. I'm too ADHD for it, but Garth's fully OCD, so he's great for the job. Anyway, this book had, you know, ads for fucking Chinese restaurants and, you know, ridiculous stuff. It actually had a full page ad about Ciba Geigy. Now, Ciba Geigy were the company that invented Ritalin, and they had been, you know, like a massive lawsuit, $15 billion, because they misrepresented what it was, what it, you know, and they reckon in America that 90% of the people that were prescribed Ritalin should never have been prescribed. Anyway, there's a massive class action, and they were sued and lost 15 billion. They changed their name. But anyway, there was an ad for Ciba Geigy in there, and I thought, fucking how perverse is this? I mean, you know, ridiculous. It's almost like they got the traditions and said, no, well, I'm going to do the 180 degree opposite of that motherfucker. And yep, no, I don't agree with that. I'm going to do, you know, good old addicts doing it their way, right?
Surely
We did
not.
people great harm, and we can harm the fellowship if we don't use the traditions. You mentioned something, Francis, about that place, and they were offering us free rent. that doesn't help us at all. And you mentioned that too. And I was happy to hear you mention that. I'm not, you know, one of my friends actually works at one of the rehab, you know, on site. They have a building that they have control over. And anyway, she said to me, oh, we've decided to, you know, it was a particular subsection of NA, you know, an Indigenous group. We've decided to give it to them for $1 a month. And I said, you don't really understand the traditions. And I'm going to explain something to you why that is not actually helpful. That's going to hurt them. You know, we need to be fully self-supporting. And, you know, the kind of rent we pay for venues is not something we can't afford. And we need to be paying our own way. That's part of becoming responsible, productive members. And you didn't really quite understand the tradition, you know, anyway, of being fully self-supporting.
All right. So now you said it was established in 76. So now how many meetings are there now, and how many committees have you formed in Australia? And did it have to be translated?
Yeah, no, we speak English down here. We have electricity as well. Anyway, I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding. I wasn't trying to be offensive, but yeah, we're part of the Western, for better or for worse, we're part of the Western culture, you know. Anyway, no, we haven't. We have looked into translations into some of our Indigenous languages, but we're not there yet. We came close a year or so ago to allocating some resources to doing that. There are some criteria, you know, how many people is it going to reach, blah, blah, blah. Right? We have to make responsible decisions about how we spend our money. So we have, I think, I remember a couple of years ago, and I know this because it came down to a vote, and I ended up being involved as the Sydney. In Sydney, we have four area service committees. We've still got that service structure here. And we have probably, and Melbourne, I would say, well, I know that we had some issue, you know, our treasurer, basically, I'll cut to the chase, our treasurer stole quite a bit of money from the regional service committee. And that was, you know, we were running things, anyway, it's quite a bit of money, somewhere between 30 and 50K, and we haven't really got it back. And, you know, the actual thing, it was funny and it was heartbreaking. But I remember putting it, they put it to a vote. And there were 18 area committees in regional Australia, or was there 28? 18 or 28, you can't remember, but that will give you some idea. That's like Australia's a massive, you know, geographically a massive thing, but a lot of it's uninhabitable and uninhabited. But anyway, I remember the vote came down to, I think, pretty much all of the areas voted to prosecute the guy. And one or two abstentions and two said no. In actual reality, because of the way we had our region set up, our treasury set up, I'm almost embarrassed to say the situation was we were signing blank checks and, you know, the actual current treasurer was not really at fault. That's how she was taught to do it, and posting blank checks around the place. So the police informed us that, in fact, there's actually nothing to charge the person with because, you know, unless you cross a check, it's, you know, it's your responsibility to cross the check. So anyway, long story short, I think we had about 18 or 20 areas there. How many meetings we have, I don't know, I still think there's like 130 or something in Sydney. I know it's grown massively in Melbourne. I don't know the numbers. So, but, you know, I know we have quite good fellowships all the way up and down the East Coast, but I'm not sure of numbers.
All right, let's take this last question and we will wrap it up. Mary.
Mary's a friend of mine. She's my Fijian friend.
I certainly am. Hi, Derek. Great to hear you. Thank you so much for that interesting information and stories and experiences. I wanted to ask you about that book. You held a book up earlier, but I didn't get the name of the book. And where is it available from? Where can we buy one?
It was printed in 96, I think, and it says a short history of Narcotics Anonymous in Australia, and I think it's actually covers from 1976 or something. The background, the formation of NA in Australia, in Australasia. In the 1960s, 70s, NA and DA from 72 to 81. It covers all of that. And comes up to the copyright is 1996. And just before, it covers basically our history up to 1996. It would be fabulous to get the history after that as well, but that'll be a
Yeah.
big job. So that copyright belongs to the Fellowship Service Office, which is an incorporated body, like World Services is, but it belongs to NA. Everything but that belongs to the service office belongs to us. You know, it's funny, during COVID, our government was pumping money into the community, and I'm on the board for the NA office. It's just a shop, but maybe it's a bit more than just a shop, but anyway, it does some other things. And anyway, the government put $10,000 into it, the Fellowship Service Office account, because it's a small business. Anyway, I had to jump up and down and to say, look, we need to send that money back. It's an outside contribution. Our tradition is not ambiguous in any way, shape, or form. And the reality is too, we didn't need it. Our literature sales didn't go up or down during COVID. If anything, they probably went up a little bit. But I got to, not it unnerved me a little at how little people really actually understood the traditions. And I actually argued with the chair of the World Board at the time. I said, no, you're wrong. We cannot keep this money anyway. Blah, blah, blah. He spoke to Anthony and a few others, and he came back and said, yeah, I think you're right. Anyway, we sent the money back. The people that worked in the office got money and handout. That's a different thing. That money doesn't go to NA, it's going to an individual, But yeah.
I would encourage
Thank
anybody
you.
to get that book now, because I paid like over $100 for my one copy while it was out of publication,
Really?
and it was a little pricey to have it shipped too. So, like they're pretty cheap right now through the regional office with Australia.
$15 Australian, which is only about, it's less than $10 American, I think. The shipping is kind of brutal. I don't know what's happened with USPS, but it's
You'll pay more in shipping than you will for the price of the book, probably to the United States, but still way cheaper than when it's out of publication. Also, I have one question about the book.
sent five to someone the other day, and it was about $30 to $40 to ship.
Question. Did you say that it was revised, like
Yeah.
for some of the Melbourne information?
The new one that's for sale. The revisions aren't much. I was sort of mandated by Tony from the Fellowship Service Office about 10 years ago to, run around and just fact check everything, which is what I did.
Great.
And there's precious little to change. I would have personally changed one thing, but I didn't want to, make
Thank
it a
you. I'm going to make a point in buying a new one then so I can have both.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you can, Francis, you've got Derek's contact information. If you could just send Francis the information on how to purchase one of those books, we'll put a link in the description of this podcast. So if you're listening, go into the description and look in the link, and we'll put a link right there so you can buy this book. And the title of the book is what exactly?
Recovery Down Under.
Recovery Down Under, Narcotics Anonymous in Australia, A Short History.
Perfect.
And would you know if the book is available in is an Audible, or is there an Audible version available?
No. Listen, what was I going to say? It's not at this stage. And I
Okay.
actually made a couple of phone calls to Tony and a few people before the meeting about a PDF. Someone asked me. The problem with a PDF is once it's out there, it's gone. There's no real copyright. And I'd need a group conscience decision to do we want to do that? If we sell a PDF, anyone can reprint it at any time. Whereas you were saying if it was an audio, where you have to pay to download it, that's a different thing altogether. That might be a way around it. I think NA should really keep copyright of it. And we have that copyright because it's, copyrighted by our Fellowship Service Office here in Sydney. I'm putting in the chat the office email address. So what you do is you just email them and say, I want 5, 10, 1 copy. blah blah blah. They'll let you know how much it'll cost by the address you give them. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, we're going to stay on a little bit after, but we're going to wrap up the recording now. So just want to say thank you, Derek, for coming on and being a guest and sharing some of that Australian history. And we're grateful for all of you that participated and asked questions. And we will be back next week with another episode. See you then.
Thank you for joining us on our Living Clean podcast. This is another platform that we can share our message of recovery, which is an addict, any addict, to stop using drugs, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. Join that no matter what club. You can contact us through text. The number is 931-306-9364.